From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in one of the hottest movies in the country right now. It might not be on your radar, because maybe you don't have a young son. I do. He wanted to go see Red One, starring The Rock and Chris Evans and Krampus. I suspect you know The Rock, probably Chris Evans, but Krampus might be new to you. Krampus was new to me because my parents did not torment me during the holiday season. But let me tell you, Krampus is a creature of folklore, and from just jumping on Wikipedia, it really seems like adults took massive pleasure in simply terrifying children. Just absolutely horrified them. Let me read a little bit to you about this Krampus character. First of all, he's generally a horned figure, but his appearance and purpose might shift depending on which folkloric tradition we're talking about. From the Eastern Alpine tradition, here's the story. Krampus accompanies St. Nicholas on the night of December 5th when they visit children. In this particular legend, St. Nicholas rewards the well-behaved children with gifts. Krampus punishes the misbehaviors with birch rods. What's this creature look like? Well, we mentioned the horns. Krampus typically is a man with horns, although he also has one grotesque human foot and one foot of a goat covered in black hair. He has a very long, snake-like tongue, and he carries chains sometimes, which might symbolize the binding of the devil by the church. And he might thrash the chains for dramatic effect, as one does. If he's in the mood, his chains will carry bells, kind of the demented version of Jingle Bells. And here's the kicker. He will swat children with those birch branches, sometimes a whip, but often birch branches. But don't worry. Once he leaves on December 5th, he might come back on Christmas Eve. This time he will travel with a sack on his back, and he might fill that sack with children. Maybe he would drown them or eat them. Merry Christmas, kids. So back to the movie, Red One. This time Krampus is described as being Santa Claus's estranged adoptive brother. He holds a grudge, but, you know, he's willing to listen and reconcile. It is Hollywood, after all. I like the idea of Krampus, the good listener. That's what I always thought about him. Now comes a book from Jeff Bellinger titled The Fright Before Christmas, Surviving Krampus and Other Yuletide Monsters, Witches, and Ghosts. Bellinger explains that there was a time in the late 1800s when people would send Krampus cards, not holiday greetings. And Krampus is not alone. There are other violent monsters who've been hunting naughty children for centuries. I love learning about other cultures and stories, traditions, and folklore. And with Red One, Krampus is back in style. Apparently there's a horror movie called Krampus, which I have zero desire to see because I don't really like stabbing or blood, but it's out there if you want to see that. And by the way, Zeus is back. Jeff Goldblum plays Zeus in the new Netflix show called Chaos, depicting a modern set of gods interacting with humans who defy them. We still love our myths, even modernized versions of them. So let's have some fun this hour. My guests include Hannah Davis in studio, founder and executive director of Flower City Folk. I did not get my Krampus card from you this year.
I'm so sorry.
Is it in the mail?
Yeah, we cut you off the Christmas list.
The Krampus list there. Thank you for being here, Hannah.
Anytime.
And Jeff Bellinger on the line with us, the author of The Fright Before Christmas, Surviving Krampus and Other Yuletide Monsters, Witches, and Ghosts. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why don't we all know about Krampus, Jeff? When did this guy kind of go away from the public consciousness?
December 1931.
Is that like literally the thing? That's
literally the thing. So Krampus started in Austria and Germany, and he was, as you had mentioned, always a cohort of St. Nicholas and would show up on Krampusnacht, which is December 5th, and he would be the consequence. He would be the punisher. And St. Nicholas could keep his hands clean and give out the rewards. He was wildly popular, not alone, as you mentioned. There's various monsters from other countries, usually northern climes of northern Europe. But Krampus went away in December of 1931 because America was trying to crawl out of the Great Depression. And Coca-Cola came up with this bright idea of using Santa Claus to sell Coke. And it worked. And at that point, Christmas became about consumerism and crawling out of debt and so on. And that's when everything changed. You know, at that point, it became about buying presents, and all those monsters had to get pushed back into the dark, creepy, shadowy recesses of our psyche.
I want to read a little bit from Jeff's book here, and I want to think about the parents who told these stories to kids and just ask if Child Protective Services was just not doing enough for centuries. Just really, as an agency, kind of lax here. Jeff writes, quote, if you're a less than perfect child, and you've been told the tales, then December 5th is circled several times in red on your calendar. This is the big day. If you survive to see December 6th, it means you behaved well enough to warrant gifts from St. Nicholas. But if on the 5th of December you hear rattling chains or bells coming toward your bedroom door during that long, dark, silent, deadly night, it's too late. Krampus has arrived. End quote. Again, Merry Christmas, kids. I mean, just this is sadistic, Jeff. I feel like I'm fascinated by the psychology of what we were doing to kids.
So maybe you haven't read the old Brothers Grimm tales, the originals. They're dark. They're very dark. So, for example, the Cinderella story, you know, the one from what Disney gave you. But in the original story, just as a quick example, the stepsisters who are trying to fit into that glass slipper and win the prince, one stepsister cut her toes off and filled the glass slipper with blood to try to wedge her foot in. The other cut her heel off and filled it with more blood. That's how the Grimm tales rolled back then. They were dark. There was a very clear evil. There was a very clear good. And I think children could handle that, because the reality is, although we can have laughs and think that, you know, someone should have been looking out for the kids, the reality is there are monsters out in the world. And it's not a coincidence that these monsters are tied to the Yuletide season, because the season has always been about the winter solstice, the shortest day, the longest night, and the oncoming deadly season of winter. And you have to be prepared, because if you're not ready, I mean, if Krampus doesn't get you, then the elements might.
Good gracious. Hannah, it took Coca-Cola to steer us in a different direction. So yay to capitalism, it turns out.
Ooh, I'm not going to.
I don't know.
I won't
this
co-sign
actually,
that one.
These myths sound really interesting. Yeah. How do you imagine Krampus?
Yeah, I mean, Jeff is absolutely right. And I want to say, too, incredible audio quality on the other end.
Yeah.
Really loving
sounds great.
This. Yeah. Good work, Jeff.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think people like this dichotomy, right? This the dark and the light, the holy, the unholy. And it's easy to use these kinds of stories as opportunities to impose those kinds of beliefs, right? One thing is good, one thing is bad. And we see that manifest in children's stories a lot. The Grimm's Brothers examples are excellent kind of parallels here. There's a lot happening that we could talk about. But I think folklorists and lots of other people love to talk about the utility of storytelling. We're doing something with these stories, and they persist because they give us a way to enforce these ideas, right? That they are tools that we can use.
In the way that we use Elf on the Shelf?
Yeah, exactly.
Except for the difference is, with Elf on the Shelf, he's watching you because the Elf on the Shelf works for the CIA and he's got connections back to Langley or the North Pole, whatever. And he lets the powers that be know if you've been bad. And if you've been bad, you may not get what you want for Christmas. In the Krampus days, if you've been bad, he eats you in a cave. I mean, it's just a slightly different tone here.
Yes, very Germanic.
I guess people, do they need these myths to sort of like cope with the long, dark winter, as Jeff says, Hannah? What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. And, you know, these stories have changed as time has gone on. We see modern iterations of Krampus and other figures like him, like Zwarte Piet in the Netherlands, for example, that become kind of tricksters. They're silly, goofy guys, right? They're not evil. They're not unholy. They're just guys who are causing chaos in the streets because we don't need that kind of you know, kind of heavy-handed moral lesson necessarily. So, you know, again, these things are doing something, right? They start that way for a good reason. In whatever context that these stories begin, people are making them dark and twisted because that is what's needed.
And so when people would send Krampus cards, is that sort of in the cheeky spirit of the season, Hannah?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of transitional period, right? These Victorian postcards are so funny. I've seen so many collections of kind of similar things that include Krampus and lots of other just bizarre imagery. But I think that we see this kind of move towards commercialism that Jeff has referenced surely earlier than 1931. But we see this kind of mass production of postcards and we see this funny imagery. Part of it because it is just kind of becoming increasingly obviously funny, right? But these are also recognizable characters and kind of beings that people can latch on to and recognize are part of this larger story.
And maybe we still see echoes of this creature. I mean, My boy loved the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild series, and those Lynels look like Krampus.
Yeah.
They scare me, man.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I kind of want Krampus cards, by the way. Jeff, do you want to add a little bit to the idea of the utility of this kind of mythology or what the myth was, how it was serving the people who were telling these stories?
Oh, all these monsters serve us. Otherwise, we wouldn't have them around.
Exactly.
We create monsters, and then we can't control them, to paraphrase it. Coen brother, but the reality is that the monsters change and evolve as we need them and what we need them to do. Krampus is the consequence. When I was young, I was told I'd get less presents if I was bad, or coal and sticks
in my stocking.
If I was really bad. The sticks obviously were a nod to Krampus and his switch of sticks and other monsters too that would beat you. But that's really not much of a consequence for behaving badly all year. There was a time where you need to understand that there is a consequence, and it could be dire. And that's life, you know? I mean, I think we've just gotten soft here in our older age. And you said earlier, Evan, that you grew up without Krampus. I would argue you actually did. You just didn't recognize him. He was green, and he lived in a mountain over Whoville. Now, am I here to accuse Dr. Seuss of plagiarism? Yes, that is exactly what I'm doing
right now. You can't plagiarize folklore.
That's right.
And Hannah, is there a religious element to Krampus here?
Absolutely, yeah. And Jeff, I assume you've done more research on this than I have, so correct me if I'm wrong here. But there's this very clear parallel with St. Nicholas and Krampus in a Christian religious context, right? We see God and the devil, or, you know, holy versus unholy again, right? Again, pointing to the kind of utility of these stories. We see that Santa is benevolent and generous and kind to children, and we see that Krampus is nasty, evil, and he whips them and, you know, drags these chains around. The Catholic Church, you know, attempted to ban Krampus and stories related to Krampus at one point, but he persisted because of the utility of Krampus. You know, we can't stop people from telling stories or staging plays in their village. Stories persist. You know, we do see this kind of, again, this duality, this idea of good versus evil in these characters. And it plays out in lots of religious contexts, too. I'd love to hear about Jeff's research in this particular kind of context again.
What do you think? Yeah, what do you think, Jeff?
Well, I don't think Krampus is evil. That's not fair. No, I'm serious.
It's reductive, like,
Is the warden of the prison evil? Is the corrections officer in the prison evil? Or are they doing a necessary job to punish the guilty? And so the thing is, Krampus represents a pagan time, and Christianity has been at war with Christmas from the year 336 AD until some of them are still at war with it, but really much more modern times, only in the last, you know, half century or so. And so there was always this struggle with, how do we squash the pagan roots of this completely pagan holiday? So on the one hand, the chains were to bind the devil. Krampus doesn't need chains, but that was added later to sort of like Christianize it. And also, just quick point of clarification, if St. Nicholas and Santa Claus are not two different people in your head right now, please try to separate them like most of the rest of the world does. Santa Claus comes on December 25th. St. Nicholas comes on December 6th. Plenty of crossover, sure. But at the same time, they are distinct in most cultures.
Okay, so a couple things here. First of all, I like this idea that the Catholic Church or Christian institutions didn't like, certainly the pagan nature of Krampus, but like just too violent. Like, did you read the Old Testament? I mean, like, Krampus is like the Old Testament, just, like with high velocity and horns. But can you elaborate a little bit, Jeff, on the difference between St. Nicholas and Santa Claus?
Sure. Santa Claus really started to evolve more in America. The Dutch brought over Sinterklaas, and that evolved, and Santa Claus started to come into his own really in the latter half of the 1800s and get associated with the Christmas holiday of December 25th. In Europe, St. Nicholas was a person who lived in the land of Myra, which is modern-day Turkey. He was the bishop of Myra, and he was born into a wealthy family and spent the rest of his life pretty much giving away his money, because that's what brought him joy, and he opened orphanages and hospitals, and he was just beloved by pretty much everyone around him. A lot of miracles are attributed to St. Nicholas, and after his death, December 6th is his day, then it was the people that started calling him saint, to the point where actually the church had to catch up and eventually also acknowledge him as a saint. More churches were named after him in Europe than all of the apostles. So he was really a popular figure, and the evolution sort of started to change around, like I said, the 1800s, as Santa Claus became the figure predominant with December 25th.
So in the songs we hear this time of year, Jolly Old Saint Nick,
yep,
we should not be conflating the two of them. That's a modern invention.
America does use the terms interchangeably, absolutely. But in other countries, they're distinct.
And Hannah had an interesting look. Your reaction to my question, Hannah, seemed to say different traditions in different places.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that
sure, fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for the purpose of radio, I think we're both being a little bit reductive, right? So there is massive conflation between St. Nicholas and Santa. They are two different traditions. However,
Yeah.
I think in most, general kind of contexts, in most European environments, certainly, St. Nicholas and Santa are the same guy in the year of our Lord 2024, right? And it's a complicated thing, but this is the nature of storytelling, the nature of these kinds of legendary figures that people use in different ways, right? So I think part of our responsibility in this modern context is to not necessarily be critical of this kind of conflation, but to understand why it's happening, right? And Jeff, you've pointed to kind of consumption and commercialization as the reason that this has happened. I think that's absolutely right. I'm not a huge fan of the, let's say, cokeified Santa, whatever.
wait,
very jolly.
Santa on Coke?
Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola.
Oh, sorry. I misheard you.
Coca-Cola-fied.
That beard's not white.
Yeah, please.
Sorry, please, we all need to behave.
When do we go live, by the way?
Yeah, when do we go live? Please
let me know when we're on.
Coca-Cola-fied.
Coca-Cola-fied.
Oh, great.
Coca-Cola-fied Santa Claus, right? We get all this lovely imagery. It's very nice, but it is incredibly commercial, right? And, I think it's okay. We can't blame people for conflating these two kind of figures. This is what we're dealing with. This is the modern context. Of course, it's true that there were two separate origins, but this is what we've got today in most European environments. Let's roll with it.
Well, let me ask both of you then. I want to ask both of you about this commercialization idea and what Hollywood does. So we have now seen Krampus in his own movie in 2015. We'll talk about that in a second. But Krampus is one of the characters in the movie that's in theaters now. I mentioned it's called Red One. It's an action film. Santa gets kidnapped. The CIA is working with these mythological characters. They're fighting killer snowmen. I mean, it's silly. But one of the sort of middle bosses is Krampus. And they've got to defeat Krampus, who happens to be in the movie Santa Claus's adoptive brother. He's got a grudge with Santa, not a fan, but they eventually convince him to get on board, and he helps at the end. And he basically has this this rapprochement with Santa Claus. And when I was talking to Hannah before the show, Hannah's like, the myth cannot do that. Like, no. What do you think, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, there's this idea of a successful narrative, right? A tellable story. And to me, that's not a tellable story. That just does not make sense.
It breaks the rules of myth. Why?
Exactly. It breaks the rules. Krampus is a foil to Santa / Saint Nick, right? We have this good versus evil, right? And yes, we can absolutely complicate that. But in this particular context, it doesn't work for Krampus to redeem himself. Krampus is a complicated guy, but sure, Krampus is also not a person that we're having an hour-long, kind of therapeutic conversation with. Krampus is a pretty two-dimensional kind of character in these stories, intentionally. So it doesn't make sense for him to have a redemption arc.
Well, I mean, he may not need redemption, right? He serves a different
right,
purpose.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I agree.
So I think it's interesting. I have to see the movie now. I probably won't buy a ticket, but I have to see it.
I don't know.
I'm curious. It's research.
Maybe. Jeff, what do you think of this idea as Krampus having a thawing out with Santa, and joining the CIA and helping get Santa? By the way, Santa, I think, is played by J.K. Simmons. Perfect choice for Santa. But what do you think of this idea that they can team up as action figures, Jeff?
Yeah, I agree with Hannah. It's taking it into a new direction that, and time will tell if that'll stick. I don't think it will. I disagree. It just like Hannah, I agree with Hannah in that it's not the right direction. And if you look at how popular Krampus walks and Krampus runs are getting, not just in Austria, but all over the United States and in other parts of the world, as cosplayers adopt this character and start to become, you know, the embodiment of Krampus. I mean, I went to the New England Society of Krampus's ball, you know, a couple of years now. It's amazing. You know, you got like 40 Krampuses all around you, and a St. Nicholas who was there too, by the way, you know, who are dressed up and sort of celebrating this darker side of the holiday. I don't see them, you know, bringing candy to orphanages or anything like that. That's not what the character is or what it does. So I don't think this movie's going to have much of an impact well, as far as changing the narrative.
But, you know, the Grinch cut the first piece of roast beast, so, you know.
He did, you're right, true.
Maybe Krampus.
There's hope for all of us, I guess.
Yeah, the Krampus Grinch's heart grew 3 sizes that day. By the way, the 2015 movie called Krampus had, like, serious actors. Adam Scott.
It was great.
Toni Collette, David Koechner. I mean, so is it horror? What is it, Jeff?
So, yeah, horror, sure. But I think they sort of nailed the spirit of what Krampus is. Sure, it got campy and there was the jump scares that you would expect and that kind of thing. But that movie is turning into a little bit of a cult classic going on almost a decade now. I liked it. It was not overly gory, but it was the spirit of what Krampus is, right? This family needed redemption. And that's the promise of the holiday, isn't it? Right? I mean, we learned that from one of the greatest ghost stories ever told by a master, right? Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens. This holiday was about redemption, that you could wake up changed in a single night, but only if you go through a gauntlet, only if you're afraid. You know, the song says, be good for goodness sake, but no one I know can do that. I mean, not me, right? We need the cancer scare. We need to lose a friend or loved one much too young, you know, to change our ways. We need to be frightened. And in that case, let me introduce you to some monsters we can call forth in this otherwise festive time of year.
Totally changing my views on Krampus, I guess. Hey, Ruth in Rochester, let me grab a phone call here. Hello, Ruth, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to recommend another movie for people to watch. It's a Finnish movie. It came out in 2010, and it's called Rare Exports, and it's Krampus adjacent, and it's really funny and also dark. Just a recommendation, in case any of you have seen it before.
What is it called?
Describe it. Rare Exports, and it's Finnish.
There's a market for this. It's so interesting. And you enjoyed
it. There's a bunch of Krampus movies, so you're aware. Just the one in 2015 is the most well-known and went to widescreen release. And then, of course, the one with The Rock as well. But if you get on the streams and just search for Krampus, you'll find many.
Okay. And this is a recommendation, Ruth? It's not just like, just be aware it exists? You're recommending it?
No, it's fantastic.
Okay.
And it's not gory. It's you know, a dark comedy.
Okay. Thank you, Ruth. Look at all the things we're learning this hour. This is so interesting. Did you know about this one, Hannah?
I didn't. No, I'm a bad folklorist. I can't wait to watch it.
I don't think you're a bad folklorist. I think there's so many different tentacles of folklore and different interpretations, although we are now clear that Santa or Saint Nick and Krampus cannot team up. They're not on the same team. They don't sub out for one another. They have different purposes. Hollywood, we've got to draw some lines somewhere. Jeff, were you familiar with what she was saying there?
Yeah, I'd heard of the movie. I haven't seen it yet. It's on my to-watch list. But yeah, if you look up Krampus movies, if you just Google that, you'll see there's a bunch. He's been the star of many of the smaller films, but you know, now he's getting more widescreen appeal. And that's how stuff comes back, right? Once it starts showing up in popular culture, then it just grows and grows. That's how our culture works.
Good gracious. Dallas emailed like 5 minutes ago. I'm just seeing this now. He said the same thing. Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale. Says, I don't think a lot of people have seen it since it's finished. It's good. Okay. After we take our only break of the hour, we can take more of your feedback as we talk about why the Christmas season is obviously the scariest time of year, especially if you're a child and your parents know about Krampus and these other pieces of folklore that are out there. But we're going to talk about some of the other parts of lore. And we're talking about why these myths still have such appeal with us. Hannah Davis is with us in studio, founder and executive director of Flower City Folk. Jeff Bellinger is on the line with us, author of The Fright Before Christmas, Surviving Krampus and Other Yuletide Monsters, Witches, and Ghosts. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org.
I'm Patrick Hoskin, in for Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, the December issue of City Magazine is here, and it doubles as the 2024 Winter Guide, with stories to help you stay warm, fed, and entertained through the snowy season. From a family-owned Christmas tree farm and a novel speed dating event, to line dancing and kid-friendly ways to play in and out of the snow, we explore it all with the city staff. Talk to you on Friday.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'll get back to your phone calls. I see the phone ringing. People are talking about things that are brand new to me. Krampus is totally new to me, although Jeff Bellinger's book is going to make sure Krampus is not new to you or someone maybe in your family. Maybe this tradition's coming back here. Maybe what we really need, maybe what the world needs, it turns out, is just a good dose of Krampus again. Jeff Bellinger on the line with us, the author of The Fright Before Christmas, Surviving Krampus and Other Yuletide Monsters, Witches, and Ghosts. Hannah Davis, the founder and executive director of Flower City Folk, with us in studio here. And just a couple of other pieces of email and listener feedback before we kind of pivot here. One listener was emailing to ask about Jeff's comments about Christianity being at war with Christmas, wants to know, when did Christianity lose that war? Hannah and I were talking during the brief break. I mean, I'm not the expert here. I would probably just guess that there's a lot of cultural reasons or even monetary reasons. What do you think, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it does boil down to money, and I'm going to defer to Jeff here because although I'm not new to Krampus, I am not good about my history of any church.
You'd be speculating.
Well, it's a little bit more than speculation, but there's this kind of mass commodification of all kinds of things in all kinds of contexts, right? And that absolutely happens, particularly in religious contexts, and I'm specifically thinking of the Catholic Church here, who was particularly kind of fiery about dealing with these pagan traditions. And so, yeah, I think it took centuries, right? This isn't something that happened overnight. But, you know, there is this kind of will of the people wanting to kind of appeal to a larger audience, et cetera, playing out. But there's also the money portion of this conversation, which I think is absolutely relevant.
Jeff, do you want to add to that?
Sure. Let me see how fast I can do this. okay. I'm just going to go as quick as I can. Interrupt me if you have to. The birth story of Jesus is not a very important part of his backstory. He was born a commoner, and commoners didn't track their birthdays back then. That's just how it was. If the Bible wanted us to know the birthday, the Bible would have told us the birthday. The only hint we get is in Luke chapter 2, where he said shepherds were living out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night when the angel of the Lord appeared. And so in Bethlehem, in that region of the world, shepherds would be out all night with their flock during spring, summer, or fall, which means the only season you can rule out is winter. How we got to December 25th, we jumped to the Emperor Constantine in Rome, who had converted to Christianity and was trying to sell Christianity to the Romans, make it no longer illegal to practice Christianity. Didn't ban the other religions. And really, what we're talking about has always been about the winter solstice. And in Rome, they had Saturnalia, which was December 17th to the 23rd. When Constantine was trying to sell Christianity to the Romans, he said Jesus has to be a king, not just a king, but a king of kings, and kings need birthdays. December 25th would be the perfect day, because in the Julian calendar, that was Sol Invictus, that was the winter solstice, the shortest day, but also the day that the sun starts to return. 336 is the first written record of the of Jesus's birthday being marked on that day. Further north, Yule was what the Vikings and the Nordic people were celebrating. That's where we get the evergreens, the trees, and so many of our so many parts of this holiday, and that's what it always was. But back then, the birth of Jesus was not a big deal. That's not what defines a Christian. The Easter story is what defines a Christian. Everybody's born. Death and resurrection, nobody does that. That gets a ton of ink in the Bible. So that's really was the big holiday for Christians. Over time, in fact, in the 1600s, the Puritans literally banned the celebration of Christmas. They called it, quote, satanical. To dress festive, make merry, give gifts, you'd be fined 5 shillings, which is about 3 days' wages for the working class people. And then a new king came on the throne, lifted the ban, but it still was frowned upon. Cotton Mather of Salem Witch Trials fame wrote in one of his sermons that we do more to dishonor Jesus in the 12 days of Christmas than all the rest of the year combined. We will go to school, go to work, business will be open, we'll go to church. This is not a holiday, this is pagan. And that's how it was, right up until Charles Dickens wrote his masterpiece, until it started to spread and become a bigger and bigger thing. until it became, you know, as Hannah said, commercialism and spending money. And the holiday got so big that no matter how hard, you know, everybody tried to suppress it, it just, the roots of this multicultural, multifaceted holiday, always centered on the winter solstice, just sort of shone through. And there was nothing anybody could do about it except throw your hands up and say, well, it was always ours. It's Christmas. And so there's still, I was talking with someone the other day. He said in his Pentecostal church, his preacher used to say, no Christmas trees. That's pagan. Stop the lights. Stop the candy canes. There's no room for that. This is not what this, you know, holiday is supposed to be about. I'm here to say you can celebrate the birth of Jesus any day you like. December 25th is just as good as any other. But just recognize that it was trying to Christianize a huge, huge party that's been going on for millennia across many different cultures.
We had an email from a listener who wants to know how closely Saturnalia tracks with this. We're going to get back to that. Let me grab a couple of phone calls first here, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about Saturnalia. Paul in Brighton first. Hello, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, today it's Cynical Paul from Brighton.
Oh, no.
And I think Hannah... is thinking along the same lines I am. When you mentioned why do we continue with these traditions and the Krampus and everything else, number one is dollar signs. And number two is the need to fill space during the holidays in all media, including yours, because there's a lot of, there's a lot of air that needs to be filled. So those are my takes on that, why it continues to be such a big deal, because it's like a self-fulfilling deal. And number two, this is completely off the topic and might be a topic for another show, but when I listen to, being a former Catholic and listening to statements about pagan rituals, I don't know, maybe I don't know the exact definition of pagan, but it's very hard for me to see any difference between someone telling me there's a cup of blood and some flesh on the altar, and not calling that a pagan religion. So sorry to you know, go off on this track, but as I say, when I hear the word pagan, it's just hard for me to separate from what I was taught many, many years ago, and decided not to follow that path. So with that, I will say happy holidays to everybody, and have a great day. Take care.
Happy holidays. That's Ebenezer in Brighton. No, it's not. Paul said, you know, maybe he is feeling a little cynical. But Hannah, what do you make of some of that first?
I think Cynical Paul of Brighton made some excellent points. I appreciate his comments. You know, I want to talk specifically about this idea of the carnival-esque, which we keep kind of talking around. And I like this idea that the Catholic traditions maybe aren't so far from what we commonly think of as pagan traditions, and how this all kind of interacts together. There's this Bakhtin, the kind of cultural theorist who was working in the 20th century, coined this term, the carnivalesque, this playing with the word carnival, this opportunity for people to just have fun, to let off some steam, right? And I think we do actually see it in some kind of strict religious contexts in unexpected ways. We certainly see it around holidays and other kind of time-related markers, right? Birthdays, festivals, fairs, et cetera, whatever. I could talk about this all day. That could be a great episode. But there's this kind of commonality between all these different things where people spend all year slogging. You know, we get to winter. It's a hell of a hard time. we need to do something, right? And of course, it's religious. Of course, there's this cultural kind of importance. But there's this idea that this is also an opportunity for us to blow off some steam, to come together, to celebrate these traditions, to talk about these guys, St. Nick or otherwise Krampus, and to join together to have fun, to enjoy the chaos, to revel together, and to celebrate in this kind of illogical, silly way. And again, we see that in some serious contexts, like in religion, but we also see it in sillier contexts, like these modern Krampus celebrations that Jeff mentioned. And I think it's an interesting idea that a thing like Krampus can be both deathly serious, very religious, very strict, right? We have these kinds of two things, right? One's fun and silly, this revelry, and the other thing is deeply serious.
Hannah, is one way to think about this in contextualizing Paul's call, would you say that one person's paganism is another's, you know, very serious, solemn, religious, and spiritual tradition and vice versa?
I mean, to be clear, paganism is alive and well today, right? And I certainly invite anybody who's listening who considers themselves a pagan to chime in, because I think this is really interesting. You know, paganism is serious. It always has been quite serious. But there's, again, this kind of commercialized common idea of what is pagan and what is not pagan. The cup of blood, right? Certain symbols, witches standing naked in the woods together, et cetera, around a bonfire. These kinds of media-centered ideas of what being a pagan or being believing in pagan beliefs looks like. It can be both things.
Well, let me ask Jeff Bellinger to weigh in on Paul's phone call. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I get it. I was raised Catholic, too. I completely understand. I want to touch a little more on what Hannah said. I forget the scholar who called it this, but he said, you know, Christmas has always been a steam valve on the year, and that's what Saturnalia is. That's what Yule is. You know, when you live in a place where winter is hard, when your farm work is done, just put your mind back just a century or two, you know, not even that long ago. When you have to wonder if you have enough food to make it through the winter, enough fuel to burn to keep warm, if your roof will hold up under all that snow, you put your differences aside, you party, you know, the wine has been made, the beer has been made, the animals have been slaughtered, they're going to keep a little better in the winter cold. So you have this festival. And also, if you go back to the Industrial Revolution, when you worked at a factory run by a water wheel, sometimes the water freezes and you're furloughed and there's not enough daylight anyway to work. So you're out of work for the whole year. If your boss gives you a feast of some kind, you may forgive that your boss is going to be living in the lap of luxury and you're going to be struggling through the winter. Even today, if you're fortunate enough to work for a company that gives you a holiday bonus, if that bonus is good enough, you'll forget a whole year of torment, right? And say, yeah, all right, I can come back in January and do this all again. It's always been a steam valve. And no matter what you want to label that, whether pagan or just society having a good time, I think we need it.
All right, Paul, you're off the hook for your Scroogeism. I think we appreciate that phone call. Good context there. Max next in Rochester. Hey, Max.
Hey, how's it going?
Very
Happy
good.
Happy holidays, everybody.
To you as well.
I wanted to ask, I wanted to ask opinions from our experts on first of you, have you heard of Festivus? And what's your take on Festivus? Because I'm hearing a lot of this, and that's the first thing that comes to mind with, like, you know, the working person's take on this whole, you're slogging through the year and you need a Festivus for the rest of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, I got a lot of problems with you people. Hannah, Festivus, what do you think? Do you have a Festivus poll?
I do not. I have friends who do. I think it's great, right? There's this kind of, very, very modern kind of simplification of what Christmas could be. I appreciate it, you know, but we could also talk about it in the commercial context, right? We're glomming onto this very media-oriented idea of what Christmas is and is not. Again, I don't think it's my role to be critical. I think it's fun. It's great. These, you know, traditions change. We interact with media in varying ways. That's not a good or a bad thing. I think it's cool. It's fun. It's probably not what I'm going to be celebrating,
Jeff,
but it's fun.
This interview does not end, Jeff, until you pin me. So go for it, my friend. What do you think, Jeff?
Oh, on Festivus? Oh, so first of all, Festivus dates all the way back to ancient times, to 1997. When Seinfeld first aired it and said December 23rd is Festivus for the rest of us. My favorite part of the holiday is the airing of grievances.
Yes.
But I don't
yes.
wait for December 23rd. I just do that all year round.
Well, exactly.
Max, do you actually celebrate Festivus?
No, I do not. But okay. I wanted to hear thoughts on the...
No, Max, thank you. I mean, I appreciate that. Some people actually do. Like, there are people who will celebrate Festivus. I mean, probably cheekily, but it's fun.
I think it's great.
It's become a tradition.
Yeah, it's kind of non-denominational. It's nice.
Totally secular. Yep. Hey, what's a tradition other than a habit that started somewhere, right? I mean, you know.
Sure.
We carry it forward because it serves us. And that's, you know, just to circle back to Krampus real quick, you know, no one of us brought Krampus back from the shadows, right? We collectively summoned him, to use a, you know, kind of a woo-woo term. Once, you know, he's showing up in pop culture, he's showing up in holiday parades in small towns all over the world, because there's something about him that calls to us, that we need him. And so we're bringing him around again, whether we like it or not.
Well, on that note, let me get this note from a dad whose daughter is six years old. He says, my daughter's always been afraid of Santa from a young age. She called him the Beard Man, and she didn't want him sneaking into the house at any time. So I told her the truth about Santa. She's got her own complicated folklore and loves figures like Mr. Bones, who are the skeletons our neighbors put up for Halloween. And she's lately been very focused on Welsh folklore, King Arthur, and also the Mary Lord.
Thank you, Jeff. I was feeling really stressed out about that.
The pronunciation there. It's M-A-R-I and the new word L-Y-W-D. So he says she's interested in that, King Arthur, and other creepy legends. And Jeff, you write about the Mary Lord in the book, right?
Yeah, the Mary Lord is the gray mare. She rises from the grave before Christmas. She's got a handler. She's got the skull of a horse that clacks and covered in a sheet. And ignore those human legs underneath the sheet. That's probably just a coincidence. And a handler will take her door to door. And there's kind of like this call and response, especially in southern Wales. And once they get inside, the Mary Lord is rewarded with treats like sweet cakes or cookies and alcohol. And anything that leads to free cookies and booze is going to catch on.
I love this idea that David's daughter is scared of Santa, but Mary Lord is just fine. Did you want to add to that, Hannah?
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts. First of all, David's daughter is a kindred spirit.
Six
we have
years
a future
old.
Folklorist
future
on our hands.
Future folklorist.
I love it. David, please, I don't know, congratulate her for me. She sounds cool. I want to be her best friend. I have to laugh because my dad is my hometown Santa Claus these days, and I kind of relate to being scared of Santa Claus. Santa has become a lot of things, right? And there are so many different traditions that we could be embracing, right? And this fixation on Santa and the particular way he looks and the particular way we're supposed to interact with him and the particular thing he's supposed to do around Christmas time, you know, it's interesting, but there's so much more going on. And I love hearing about David's daughter looking beyond this very specific tradition that we've all glommed onto.
Timothy writes to say, could you ask about the role of Zwarte Piet, Black Peter in the Dutch tradition?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, Hannah?
Yes, yeah.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so Zwarte Piet is another kind of trickster character who very problematically traditionally wears blackface. So this is a hot topic of conversation in modern contexts amongst European scholars in particular. But again, it's one of those characters that's changed a lot over time. And I have to admit, it's been a long time since I've read about this tradition and spent any time there. But these days, we really talk about it in this kind of troubling, you know, like, is it okay for him to wear blackface kind of context, not the larger, well, this is a steam valve, this is a carnival-esque kind of fun experience. But exact same idea, right? He goes house to house, he delivers treats and sweets, and, you know, there's this, you know, kind of revelry, right? This idea that we're all just kind of messing around and having fun around the holidays. It's the same kind of character role in the holiday season.
Okay, Jeff?
Yeah, so Black Peter, he was invented in 1850 in a children's book. He was the Moor child that was sort of rescued. He was a slave, but then became sort of the slave of St. Nicholas, which is complicated. And 1850 was also pretty much the height of the Dutch slave trade, whose biggest customer was the United States. And he was always a companion figure. When slavery ended shortly after the U.S. Civil War over in that part of the world, Zwarte Piet continued. In modern times, they really struggle. And I've got some friends in there, and we talked extensively about the modern parades. As you mentioned, it's now always a person in blackface, which was not the original, you know, character anyway. But to sort of soften the blow, they're having the same sort of arguments over there that you can imagine, right? So is it tradition or is it racism? You know, and so now there's rainbow Piet, where there's every color, every face color. And then there's also Schorsten Piet. Forgive me if I butchered that, but it's chimney Piet. So it's just a dirty person, like covered in soot, who comes down the chimney to sort of be the, you know, be the enforcer and the punisher. Mm. And over in that tradition, he would take the naughty children. And if they're really naughty, they go back to Spain with St. Nicholas, where they're either re-educated or you never hear from them again, which is, I think, even more frightening.
I mean, I'm getting people are sending me Krampus cards digitally, and I just sent a Krampus cartoon where Santa is having a conversation with Krampus, and Santa says, Okay, so I'll be Santa, the Christmas hero. You'll be Krampus, the villain. Krampus says, yes, love it. What will you do? Santa says, well, if the kids are good, I'll bring them, like, an orange. And Krampus says, perfect. And then if they're bad, I'll kidnap and eat them. And Santa says, does that feel disproportionate? And Krampus says, well, what if you put the orange in a large sock? End of cartoon. So there you go. A little bit of the having fun with the tradition that a lot of listeners maybe not have known existed. By the way, another listener sent a happy Saturnalia note. I remember talking about Saturnalia years ago on this program, and what it made me feel, Jeff, was kind of a kinship. The idea that some of the traditions have evolved, have changed. Some have religious underpinnings or ostensible religious underpinnings, but a lot of the way we celebrate and make merry this time of year hasn't changed all that much. There's something actually kind of beautiful about that.
Absolutely. So Saturnalia was about flipping society over for a week. You know, no school, no work. The courts weren't opened. You'd have a Lord of Misrule, which might be chosen at random, or you just have that one cousin, you know, would just make things the liveliest. You could get away with saying things to your bosses and masters that you would never get away with the rest of the year. They would become the servants. They would serve you dinner. You would feast. You would get drunk. You would have wild parties. And it was basically a steam valve. And then when it was over, you go back to the way things are supposed to be. It was a way to just, you know, get it all out of your system, have this incredible party for, you know, a whole week. You're honoring the god Saturn. Satis means to sow. And so you're taking in the harvest and celebrating all of those things before you hunker down for the winter.
I mean, Hannah, I don't know about telling your boss off, because I feel like next week they're going to remember.
It's true.
Yeah.
Mine would.
Do you like when people say happy Saturnalia? Is that fun?
I think it's lovely. Yeah. You know, again, I like kind of looking beyond our kind of day-to-day ideas of what we should be doing with this time of year. I think the essence of all of these traditions are beautiful. I think, you know, people undeniably like to join together and have fun. We like to drink. We like to eat sweets, right? Especially when the weather is miserable. People in Rochester know that perhaps best of all. There's something unifying in all of these traditions, despite the kind of problematic faces of some of them, literally problematic faces. And that we can celebrate, you know, whatever you call it. It's lovely.
Well, I want to say we haven't even been able to get through all of the characters in Jeff's book or the kinds of stories that, of course, Hannah loves. So let me just grab a couple more of these examples before the hour. This has been such a fun hour. Jeff writes about La Befana of Italian origin. She's a witch. Today, he writes, La Befana is an old, ugly hag of a woman, but inside lies a heart of gold. However, there was a time when her exterior was just as beautiful as her interior. Befana arrives on January 5th, the eve of Epiphany, and fills the socks or shoes of good children with candy and toys. The naughty kids receive lumps of coal, onions, or garlic. But we've heard that candy and toys and stockings part before from other Christmas bringers. What sets Befana apart is that after delivering her goodies to the children, she's been known to clean your house before she departs. And Jeff concludes, sign me up. Do people still celebrate La Befana, Jeff?
They do. So some of the folks I talk to, keep in mind that the 12 days of Christmas, it's Christmas Day and 12 days thereafter, Epiphany Eve, Befana comes. And by the 6th, like, they are done. And keep in mind, she's not bringing like Santa caliber gifts, right? She's bringing small stuff like cleanup. Oh, you didn't get that marker set you wanted, or you know, maybe just some treats or some cookies or something like that. Because really, by January 6th, like, everybody is just finished with the holiday. It is time to clean up, put it away until next year. And so she sort of heralds in that cleanup. And so, I'm not Italian. That's not my heritage. But I do want to adopt her. If I could somehow get her to my house this year, that'd be great.
Any characters we've missed that we should know about, Hannah?
Oh, there's so many. But, you know, again, I guess I'll play the role of bad folklorist here. There are elements of all of these characters in, I think, actually, literally, every different cultural tradition, right? So we do play a little bit of a risk by naming specific ones, because these are, again, kind of reliably human characteristics or things that we, you know, could only dream of, right? You know, a witch cleaning your house after the holidays sounds fantastic, right? And I'm sure that there are other iterations of that character, right? Because there's this, you know, there are all kinds of different ideas about how these stories begin. But essentially, we're making up stories, we're making up characters about things that we all love, characteristics that we hold dear, or things that we're deeply anxious about, deeply afraid of, right? And they all manifest in different ways. There are thousands of different characters that we could sit here and talk about. And, I guess I'll just, back out, and not name any of them, because there are literally so many that we can't even really get into it.
Well, and but as the hour closes here, I just want to ask you for your 20-second take on this. Netflix comes out with a show called Chaos. Jeff Goldblum stars as Zeus. It's an incredible cast, and they're having fun looking at the modern lens of it. Will you watch it? And why do we still want to know about these characters on Mount Olympus?
That's a strong yes. It's on the short list. We care about these characters and their stories for all of the reasons that Jeff and I have talked about and the listeners have been chiming in on. Again, these are kind of unifying human traits that we all recognize, we all have strong opinions about, right? We, Zeus is the kind of archetypical god. He's strong, he's masculine, whatever. That, undeniably, that's a kind of archetype that people find interesting and powerful, perhaps, and interesting to watch. That there's just these kind of undeniable truths that we want to glom onto. Again, it's not a good or a bad thing, but these are things that throughout time are always going to hook us.
You going to watch Chaos, Jeff?
I've already seen it. Loved it. I did. No, I loved it. I thought it was
three
great.
Episodes
and my
in.
Whole family watched it.
Yeah, I'm hooked. I really enjoy it. Jeff, where can people... We will link to Jeff's book, The Fright Before Christmas. You got a website you want to share for people to learn more about the work you're doing?
Sure thing. It's my name, jeffbelanger.com.
Good.
You can
gracious.
Find my podcast, New England Legends.
I mean, the whole hour, Jeff. I mean, it's like we could have talked before and you could have just said Belanger.
Don't call me late to dinner.
Jeff Belanger is a remarkable guest here, and we will link you to everything he's doing. Jeff, this was great fun. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Hannah, Flower City Folk, where do people get in touch?
Flowercityfolk.org. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. Keep tabs on us. We do some fun story-related stuff around the holidays. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll put it in our show notes as well. This was so fun. Thank you for being
here. Thank you.
Happy Saturnalia.
Happy Saturnalia.
Or whatever it is that you celebrate. Listeners, have a great day. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.